And good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, here in Portland, Oregon, USA. My name is Andrew Geller, and today I've got one of those news summary review shows for you. We do these every so often, sometimes just because I can't stand not reporting on some of the stuff that I come across during the week, and sometimes because my life got crazy and I couldn't come up with something else. I won't tell you which one it is this week. Okay, we just heard on the previous program, and apologies to those of you who listen to this program later and not following our immediately previous show, but we just had a program talking about Deputy Prime Minister of Iraq, Ahmad Chalabi. And thanks to Chris for that. I want to actually start out by sharing excerpts from a statement from the floor of the House of Representatives from California Congressperson George Miller. This is from Monday, the 7th of November, and I will be paraphrasing. Madam Speaker, somebody ought to call the cops. Now, I'm not talking about collusion, corruption, or cronyism and the leaking of classified information damaging the national security of the United States. I'm talking about another shadowy figure and administration ally. I'm talking about Ahmad Chalabi, Deputy Prime Minister of Iraq, convicted bank swindler who fed the Bush administration false intelligence about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction and capabilities, as well as Iraq's ties to terrorism. Mr. Chalabi convinced Vice President Richard Cheney that the U.S. would be greeted as a great liberator in Iraq. He also fed stories about Iraq's weapons capabilities to New York Times reporter Judith Miller. The bottom line is that Mr. Chalabi played a central role in the orchestrated deception leading to the invasion of Iraq. After the administration discovered this, instead of investigating, the Department of Defense has attempted to prop Mr. Chalabi up as a candidate in the post-war Iraq government. Next, Chalabi was suspected of leaking classified information about U.S. intelligence capabilities to Iran, telling the Iranians that we had broken their code and were learning information about their activities. 17 months ago, then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice promised an FBI inquiry into who leaked the information to Iran. Nothing has happened. Despite the fact that Mr. Chalabi is a prime suspect, the FBI has never interviewed him. And just this week, the administration invited this criminal to meet with the Secretary of State and possibly even the Vice President to discuss his candidacy for the Iraqi presidency in this December's election. I would be curious to learn from the president what role granting a U.S. entry visa to a man suspected of spying for Iran plays in this administration's terrorism strategy. Mr. Speaker, somebody should call the police. Mr. Chalabi should not be allowed to roam free on the streets of this nation's capital. Excerpts from a statement read on the floor of the House of Representatives by Congressman George Miller from California 2 days ago, Monday, November 7. And just bear with me here as I kind of flip around and figure out what it is I'm going to hop to next here. Well, in the news this week, I heard about it Monday night. On the BBC here, which was already Tuesday morning in Italy, where Rai TV, the state-run 24-hour news channel, aired a documentary that says the United States was using illegal weapons a year ago in the assault on the Iraqi city of Fallujah, which, my understanding, still continues. Though not in the same scale. There's been a lot of controversy about the use of white phosphorus as a weapon. The U.S. military has not denied using white phosphorus, but they claim that they use them, the white phosphorus flares, they call, or shells, for illumination purposes only, and it should be noted, and this is kind of where it got confusing in that whole realm of conflicting and complementary international legal agreements. The United States is a signatory to the 1997 Chemical Weapons Convention. However, it is not a signatory to earlier weapons conventions. And they say that it is kind of this shading of interpretation that allows them to still make use of white phosphorus. The Independent in London yesterday said that, quote, new information has surfaced which provides graphic proof that phosphorus shells were widely deployed in the city as a weapon, end quote. If that was true, that is illegal. And I don't know which of the competing chemical weapon convention treaties applies or doesn't. I will leave that up to other journalists to ferret out further. And I would suggest that folks interested in this go check out Rye TV. Let me see if I have their website here sort of instantly. Let me see. Page 6 and 9. Okay. Rye TV's website, I don't see it. Anyway, if you search for, if you go to any good news search engine and search in quotes for white phosphorus, you'll find the Italian TV station's website. That's what I did. The story is being picked up by American media. Christian Science Monitor had a good story. This complements allegations since a year ago and in the past 12 months that, in fact, the U.S. was using illegal chemical weapons, including nerve gas, according to an Iraqi health ministry official last March, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, that story will continue to develop along the lines of possible secret and or illegal U.S. military activities in the conduct of what is referred to erroneously, in my opinion, as the war against terrorism. Stories broke recently regarding the use of secret detention facilities, secret prisons. The CIA is implicated. There's a controversy as to whether prisons are in Poland, Romania, I believe Yemen was also mentioned. And very interestingly, the White House will not admit or deny the presence of secret CIA prisons around the world. Now, the not admitting part's pretty straightforward. I understand that. What I don't understand is why the White House cannot deny the existence of CIA prisons. Is the CIA withholding information from the White House? Is the CIA possibly upset with the executive branch of the Bush administration? Interesting questions. Again, others will have to find more detail out on that story. Let's see here. This was sort of interesting. This happens basically every year. This is from SwissInfo.org via Reuters. Nearly every country in the UN General Assembly told the United States Tuesday to lift its four-decade-old embargo against Cuba in a record vote of 182-4 with one abstention. The vote, held for the 14th consecutive year, was on a resolution calling for Washington to lift the U.S. trade, financial, and travel embargo. Voting no were the United States, Israel, Palau, and the Marshall Islands. Micronesia abstained. El Salvador, Iraq, Nicaragua, and Morocco did not vote. Cuba has been under a U.S. embargo since President Fidel Castro defeated a CIA-backed assault at the Bay of Pigs in 1961. The measure is non-binding and has had no impact on the United States, with the Bush administration having tightened restrictions against Cuba, including penalties against U.S. and foreign firms, visits from Cuban Americans, licensed travel, and remittances to families. Cuban Foreign Minister Felipe Perez Roque said, quote, in terms of insanity, this draconian prohibition should go into the annals of the Guinness Book of Records. He further said that in 2004, the U.S. government imposed fines on 316 citizens for breaching provisions of the embargo. That number rose to 537 this year, up through October 12. Quoting the Cuban foreign minister again, never before, as in the last 18 months, was the blockade enforced with so much viciousness and brutality. In Washington, a State Department spokesperson said, quote, and I think this is beautiful and ironic, quote, we are acting in response to a regime that represses its people and stands in the way of their progress and freedom. That from Swiss Info yesterday. Now, it's not exactly where I was thinking about going right away, but might as well. State Department official accusing Cuba of repressing its people and standing in the way of their progress and freedom. Let's take a quick look at what's going on here in the U.S. Did y'all know that the Senate and House are finalizing the new Permanent Patriot Act? That's right. There's a tremendous, brilliantly written story from a couple of days ago by Barton Gellman at the Washington Post all about the national security letter activity of the Federal Bureau of Federal Bureau of Investigation, the American Civil Liberties Union, online at ACLU.org, just a couple days ago released a report documenting the, well, let's just say wild and broad use of national security letters, 30,000. The aspects of the Total Information Awareness Program, some of the more insidious aspects of the Patriot Act, all these things are being implemented in a scope beyond what many people had feared. I would refer people to the ACLU's website. Go and check out the Patriot Act information. Go and check out the National Security Letter information. And I want to read a little bit here from an article distributed by Z Magazine from Mike Whitney. This is November 4, a week ago Thursday. It is prefaced by a quote from former Attorney General John Ashcroft, the man who lost an election to a dead person. Quote, those who scare peace-loving people with phantoms of lost liberty, my message is this. Your tactics only aid the terrorists, for they erode our national unity and diminish our resolve. They give ammunition to America's enemies and pause to America's friends. From the article, did you know that under the terms of the new Patriot Act, prosecutors will be able to seek the death penalty in cases where, quote, from the October 30th New York Times editorial, defendants gave financial support to umbrella organizations without realizing that some of its adherents might eventually commit violence, end quote. Changing the language there, what that means is that if someone unknowingly gave money to a charity that was somehow connected to a terrorist organization, that financial contributor could theoretically be executed. Or did you know that the Senate Intelligence Committee is fine-tuning the details of a bill that will allow the FBI to secretly procure any of your personal records without probable cause or a court order, which will give them unchecked authority to pry into personal and business matters? New York Times, October 19. Or that on June 29th, George W. Bush put a broad swath of the FBI under his direct control by creating the NSS, National Security Service, the first secret police in our 200-year-plus history. It will be run exclusively by the president and be on the range of congressional oversight. Or that on October 27th, George W. Bush created the National Clandestine Service, headed by CIA Director Porter Goss, which will, quote, expand reporting of information and intelligence value from state, local, and tribal law enforcement entities and private stakeholders, end quote. Now, just to refresh your memory, that's what the Total Information Awareness Program was basically going to do. Back to Mike Whitney's article, or that Pentagon intelligence operatives are now permitted to collect information from U.S. citizens without revealing their status as government spies. Or that within 2 years, every American driver's license and passport will be made according to federal uniform standards, including microchips with biometric information, which will allow the government to trace movement of all its citizens at all times. Or, lastly here, that recent rulings, the D.C. District Court unanimously decided in two different cases that foreign prisoners have no rights under international law to challenge their indefinite imprisonment by the United States, and that the president can lock up an American citizen, quote, without charges, end quote, if he believes that he may be an enemy combatant. So I'm going to stop there. There's a whole lot more to this article. It's called Drifting Towards a Police State, Mike Whitney. This was posted on ZMag November 4th, and I will be back in a couple of moments with some more news here for you. Enjoy a little Coltrane. I know it doesn't seem fair to cut John off like that, but I just needed a short little break. That was a teeny bit of the alternate take of the Africa Brass Sessions, John Coltrane. Quite phenomenal. Okay, you are listening to People Rise Up on KBOO here in Portland, Oregon. My name is Andrew Geller, and I'm just doing a news summary here today. A little bit after the program's over, I will post URLs for the articles I reference and some that I will not get to today, so you can check out the full text of what I'm paraphrasing herein for you. I'm going to go to a little bit of environmental and trade-related news following up on some previous programs. This actually doesn't follow up on a previous program, but it will segue right into the climate issue. On October 30th, the Sydney Morning Herald out of Australia had a great article regarding the Amazon River Basin, which is currently suffering its worst drought in over four decades. Over 1,000 towns and hamlets that rely on the river for transportation have been totally cut off as water levels fall, making the river unnavigable. Many major tributaries, as well as parts of the main stem Amazon itself, contain only a fraction of its normal volume of water, and many lakes are drying up. It's approximately 38 degrees Celsius this time of year down in the region, and the level of the Rio Negro, a significant tributary to the Amazon, is down 25%. The Amazon itself has hit its lowest level in 36 years since records have been kept at its source in Peru. Greenpeace Brazil's climate campaigners said the drought and its effects are really shocking. And cutting to an article Friday, November 5, from The Guardian by Sue Branford, titled "Ecological Implications of the Amazonian Drought Affect Us All," She notes that the Amazon contains one-fifth of all fresh water on the Earth, carrying more water than the world's next 9 largest rivers combined. Kind of staggering. Let's see here. Okay, so there's a description here. I'm going to try and paraphrase of the watering cycle of the Amazon basin. So basically, because of the prevailing winds at the equator, winds blow off of Africa across the tropical Atlantic. They're full of moisture. They drop their moisture across the Amazon rainforest. When that air hits the Andes at the western edge of South America, it is pushed way up into the atmosphere, and then it is impacted more by the jet stream as opposed to the surface turning of the earth. The air goes back over the Atlantic to Africa in a higher altitude cool cycle, wherein once it hits Africa, it drops and warms again. This process drives the world's weather. Let me see here. Carlos Nobre, a senior scientist at a Brazilian Institute of Space Research and a leading climatologist, says that if the Amazon loses more than 40% of its forest cover, it will reach a turning point where the world's largest forest will begin an irreversible process of savannahization, being the savanna, much like lots of the African continent. The consensus is that a smaller forest will be unable to sustain the convection process and will start drying out. Until last week, it was widely assumed only 17% of the Amazon, an area larger than France, had been felled. However, an article printed in the journal Science last month shows that new satellite imagery on which the old satellite images on which this figure were based were not telling the full story. New images are able to detect selective logging tactics, and as a result of this more precise tracking method, they've determined that the rate of destruction of the Amazon is nearly twice as serious as had been thought. If you're looking at 17%, nearly doubling, you're getting close to the 40%, and people are deeply concerned regarding these things taking place down in the Amazon. Again, articles will be posted so you can find out more about this. Related to things climate, a new study published in the journal Climate, this is from earthtimes.org last Wednesday, a new study published in the Journal of Climate claims that if the dangerous heat-trapping gases continue to be discharged at the present rate, it is likely to result in severe climatic changes the world over in the years to come. Chances are excellent that these will take place at a very rapid speed, seldom seen before in nature. This is based on a study conducted or led by Bala Govindasamy, a Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory Atmospheric Science, and they make projections from 1870 through 2300, which is apparently the longest time frame for this type of study. And basically, they, without getting into a whole lot of detail, they show that things will happen way more rapidly than is previously thought. And they think that temperatures in the Arctic and somewhat less the Antarctic, but the Arctic will warm in the next couple of centuries by over 25 degrees Fahrenheit. They predict the virtual loss of tundra as an ecosystem. Arctic sea ice will virtually disappear, and cold, temperate rainforests the world over will disappear. Moving on to more positive news here. The WTO is still failing. They're having emergency talks in London Monday and Tuesday. There's more talks in Geneva today. And where's the Jamaican minister's statement? Because, man, was he on it. Let's see. 12, 13, 14, 15, 13, 14. Excellent. Okay. So this is from last Friday's Jamaican Observer. John Tsang, Hong Kong Secretary for Commerce and Industry and chair of the upcoming WTO ministerial, is on a tour through the Caribbean and has been warned by Jamaica that if issues of concern to developing countries are not seriously addressed, the Hong Kong talks will fail. Jamaica's Foreign Affairs and Foreign Trade Minister K.D. Knight told Tsang during talks in Kingston last Friday, quote, development issues must be given due weight and due importance. Additionally, from the Financial Times Monday via tradeobservatory.org, WTO Director General Pascal Lamy, former EU Trade Commissioner, has set mid-November as the target for a draft of a Hong Kong declaration. Ministers are currently trying to focus on narrowing differences over opening markets for agricultural goods. Trade diplomats say that if there is no breakthrough in the talks this week, preparations for Hong Kong will need to center on a damage limitation exercise that seeks to salvage what it can from negotiations in the hope of catching up next year. As previously noted in this program, when we spoke with Alexandra from the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy a week or two back, negotiators do face a sort of, it's not a official deadline of the end of 2006 to conclude the Doha trade round, but U.S. negotiating authority granted from Congress to the office of the president runs out in mid-2007. No one expects it to be renewed. So, I am just about out of time. These and many other articles will have URLs available at the People Rise Up website at kboo.fm from the program schedule. Click People Rise Up Wednesday morning at 10. There's several things regarding Bush, Cheney, Syria, Iran, and many, many other things that I just couldn't get to, but I'll post many of those articles online so you can read them for your very own. If you have questions about anything you heard today or any other day on this program, feel free to email me, kboo@riseup.net. I appreciate you listening.